Right now, we're going to head into the interview studio with Judith Merriweather.
With me in the KRVS studios this afternoon are Mary Bate, who is a curator at the Acadiana Center for the Arts, and Lisa Osborne, an artist, a sculptor, who will be showing in the exhibit in the main gallery opening for this second Saturday Art Walk. So before we talk specifically about Lisa's work, Mary, maybe you can tell us about this exhibit. It's a figurative exhibit, and I know you and Brian are both very excited about it.
Right. The exhibition is titled Reconfigure, Transformations of the Body. And it has 20 artists, several from Lafayette. We have J.J. Wilson from Lafayette. We have Cheryl Savoy, who teaches at UL. She's from Lafayette. We have Eugene Martin, who has since deceased, but he lived in Lafayette. And Donald LeBon, who has a gallery downtown, is also from Lafayette. Then we have a lot of artists from Louisiana and New Orleans. And we also have a few artists from elsewhere, one from Philadelphia, and Leslie Dill is from New York. So it's a broad show, and it is a figurative show. And it's not just a figurative show where we have just the body. It's the body is the subject matter, and the body is abstracted. There are some intact bodies in the show, but a lot of the bodies are abstracted. And so we're really excited about it. It'll run through from August 11th through October 13th.
How did you and Brian come up with the idea for the show? Was this something that had been building, something you all wanted to do, or had people in the community requested that?
No. How Brian and I work is we just we see stuff, and then we have files. We have a lot of files, and we have all these ideas for different shows, and we just start to put names inside the files. And when we get enough names in a file, we'll say, like, oh, I think we're ready to do a show about this. So it's a really a collaborative process. Or we won't even have, say, enough names. We'll have 10 names. This show is 20. And then once we start churning, the idea gets going about who and how we want to do it and how we'd like there to be a psychological aspect to it, or you know, the idea of abstraction, or the idea of how a person will contemporarily use the figure. Then we'll look. We always look. We look so much. And before we do any show, we always go through all the galleries in New Orleans, and we talk to people, and we listen, and we look for new ideas and new people, because we want to keep it fresh.
Hmm. And I got a chance to just peek down from the second floor a couple days ago when you were putting some things together. And it's always fascinating to see the collection of work that you and Brian put together. And it's like a work of art, watching and listening to you all talk about how you're going to arrange it in that space, which is a beautiful space.
Right.
But as you said, it's the way in which you arrange it that really makes the exhibit.
Sure. We always want everyone. We don't want to have one spot that's the prime spot. We want everyone to look amazing. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, there's a lot of poetry in it, you know, where you find one image that has reference to someone else's image or sculpture that's different, you know, but there's a thread of commonality. Mm-hmm. So we try to orchestrate it so that the show will inform itself, and that you leave with this bigger experience and not just a few great hits, mm-hmm. but like this whole kind of like a feel for it. Mm-hmm. So, and also hopefully we expand what you're looking for, you know, or your concept of what a figurative show would be. So, yeah.
You all did a great job with the landscape show in
that.
Thank you very
much.
Sort of making people think about their preconceptions about
what
landscape is.
Exactly. That's mm-hmm. what we're hoping to do again.
All right. Well, how did you encounter Lisa's work?
Brian said to me, hey, we got to go see Lisa Osborne. She lives out on Avery Island, and it's really cool. And so we went out there just to, like, check it out. And after we left, actually, Lisa was one of the first persons we thought about. I said to Brian, I said, you know, Brian, I think we ought to do a figurative show. And he's such an agreeable person.
And files had gotten big enough by that time.
And he's such an agreeable person. And he's like, yeah, okay, sure. And then, you know, our brains started churning, mm-hmm. you know. And it was like a lot of people just have been doing stuff. Like the Donald LeBlanc's work, he currently does work. But the work we're using in the show is from 1987. Mm-hmm. And it's his leg heads, which are these heads, these portraits of his family. And they're just on legs, their own legs. They're the portrait of mm-hmm. the leg. And they came about when his grandmother passed away and he thought about losing the body and what would be the essential thing he'd have to have. And he'd have to have this leg to kind of get around, you know, and do things with. And so, you know, the people just kind of fell into the folder, let's put it that way. And then the show kind of grows. Yeah. And as we start, like, culling through images on the internet of people that we know or that are regional, you think, well, this would be, someone would balance out the show or add another another idea to the show. J.J. Wilson is a recent graduate from UL, and he did a piece upstairs that he tattooed on the wall in the Maya Gallery. And we thought, well, what happens? Because he does all this kind of disembodied godlike figures. And I said, well, why don't we tame J.J. in and make him do something? So I did 8 panels, and they'll stack. And it's over 10 feet tall and probably about 10 feet wide. And, you know, make him say, hey, you're in a figurative show? Can you handle this concept? And he did it beautifully. So, you know, the idea kind of grows.
Right, again, breaking our preconceptions about figurative art. Mm-hmm. So the two of you went to Avery Island to see Lisa's work, and what was your response to it?
Well, she had some work done, and we're like, this is very interesting. There's a theatrical, a bit dark side to her work. And we're like, it's sculpture, too. And we don't get as much sculpture. Just in general, we don't really see as much sculpture in our area. And so it was, and what we saw is in the show, but she since then made a whole nother body of work, which is different from the initial art that we saw. But again, it's all figurative work, you know, and some of it very, very tall. I don't know how tall, maybe 20 feet, 18 feet tall.
Yeah, it must be.
There are pieces that tall in the show?
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess being up where I was, I couldn't tell how high some of them
were.
Yeah,
they're really, really big pieces. And so anyway, we said to her, hey, you know, we're going to do this show. It's this summer, at the end of the summer. We want you to be in it. And her eyes went,
I had to get busy. Well, Lisa Osborne, you have family from Louisiana.
Yes, I do.
But your parents went up to the Northeast, and you grew up in the Northeast.
Yes, I did.
Where exactly did you grow up?
In New York City and Boston.
Right. Yeah. And have moved back here within the last 10 years
Very
or so.
Very happily with my two children. Yeah.
Well, tell us about being an artist. You know, still, I mean, you live with it, you work with it, you breathe it, you sculpt it. Mary does too. She's a curator.
Yes.
But, you know, there's a lot of lay people out there who think art is something mostly children do, and we encourage our children to do it, and it seems like a good thing. But at some point, they tend to be discouraged. And so when somebody goes on and does art, immerses themselves, thinks of themselves as an artist, it is an unusual thing for many people. When did you first start thinking that this was something serious to you, that you would like to pursue that?
Oh dear, something serious. Well,
Something passionate, something you had to do.
I always knew that I wanted to be an artist. I mean, somehow when, you know, do you want to be a fireman or a, I knew very certainly, and know that I knew by third grade, I think, that I wanted to. But when I didn't think that it was something that I could do. I didn't think I was, you know, I can't draw, I can't do anything. But I think it was just because I had to. And I started off in college not being in art school. I never did art in high school or anything like that. So it's really just I really wanted to and decided that it didn't matter if I was good at it or not. I just decided I had to do this. And I think that that was one of the biggest thing was just not really worrying about what happened.
Well, included in that thought that that's something you had to do, you said you can't draw, you can't, but what was it that drew you? Were you attracted to other artists? Did you just love art? Was it some, what was it that drew you on all those years?
That's true. What did? I think it's the making things, making an object, being able to think of something and having it happen, having it become real. I should have probably become an engineer or something, made or a
different kind of art.
Exactly. It's making stuff. I think it's really transforming things, I think, is the thing that's so interesting.
So not just the drawing, but it is the actual making with your hands.
No, I'm not 2D. Mm-hmm. I'm not very good at 2D. I mean, I can. I think it's just a skill, but I'm not gifted at drawing.
Well, was there a progression of what you made things with? What was your sculptural progression?
Yes, very much so. I think I started with I went to art school and we had to learn, there was foundation and you learn how to do basic things with, you know, glue and paper and everything else. And then drawing. You had to do drawing. And then the school, the particular school that I went to, was very academic, and we learned how to make molds of things. We learned how to make big clay people. I had chosen 3D, and mostly it was figurative, and we learned how to make molds and cast these giant life-size people. And it really didn't seem terribly arty to me, but I did work in the tech shop, and I helped them make molds of skulls and bones and other things that we needed, legs and heads.
That almost seems like they were training you all to do kind of you know, art you put in front of a library, like a statue to commemorate something.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm.
You know, the general so and so on his horse in front of the courthouse.
Three legs on the ground means he's dead. And
yes, so that sounds like a bit of that training.
Very much so.
Mm-hmm. And but you were obviously learning skills.
Yes, and I think that that's really important, especially when you're not just amazingly talented from an early age. And I learned how to manipulate
materials. Yeah. Now, you did mention, as we were talking earlier, and your family's from Louisiana, some from this part of Louisiana, and some from Lake Charles.
Yes, I did.
We have a lot of listeners in Lake Charles.
I did some time at McNeese. Loved the art department there. Mm-hmm. It was wonderful.
And what did you learn there? What was coming down to South Louisiana, how did that change your art education?
Well, the art that I'd been doing at Boston University was, at the time, the school's different now, but at the time it was very academic and very, just these anatomy and life-size figures and portrait busts and portraits. And here it was, when I was at McNeese, it was actually, we were making art. It was being able to do really whatever you wanted. I immediately learned how to silk screen and do a lot of other things that I hadn't been able to do in the kind of art school that I was in before. So it was a wide open kind of thing for me. It was a really wonderful experience. It was a great department.
So you spent a year there at McNeese.
Yes, I did.
And what happened after that? Because that was sort of your senior year, I think.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, a lot of things happened.
Artistically.
Yeah, we'll jump over that. And I went to craft school because I really thought that was what I was going to be able to do.
Again, making things with
making
your
things. I chose clay, and I found out that I did not have I love to throw, and I love clay, and I'm very dedicated to clay. But I found out that I really wasn't a potter at all. I'm really not domesticated enough or something. But I love...
You were thinking back on those 18-foot creatures.
Not yet. I was thinking forward to them. But I thought that... I loved clay, and I learned how in craft school to manipulate the material again and got very confident with it, which was a little bit cocky, but confident. And then I went to graduate school at Massachusetts College of Art, and they had just installed all these new kilns, brand new kilns, that I could stand in. And suddenly it occurred to me that I could really make anything I wanted out of clay.
It was
really seeing those kilns I could make huge things. This is so great. But what was really interesting is that I didn't have very much technical help when I was at Mass Art. It was the graduate program was just graduate students in all disciplines together, which was interesting because it was mostly about thinking about things. But I got people would say, well, you should build the figures with styrofoam inside of them, which is hilarious if you know anything about clay and firing them. And
what happens to styrofoam?
Right, exactly, and brain tumors. And So I had to end up learning. I learned how to do it all on my own, which was really fun and very. I'm very lucky, very, 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 very lucky to have been the graduate student that had those kilns to play with and everything.
Well, it sounds like you've had some fortunate education along the way, and you've approached it in a really good way too, taking each stage and adding that to your skills and thinking about how you could use all of them and what was driving you in art. So you went through graduate school, and then a lot of things happen after graduate school. You know, then you sort of have to go into the world you teach or sell or, you know, that's the point at which some people think, okay, now what do you do as an artist? How do you think of yourself as an artist after that? And what happened to your art after you finished your formal education?
Well, I think that was, it was being able to set up a studio. And when you're a sculptor and you make, it was like getting obtaining gravity or something. I had to have a place where I could make clay and fire clay and build these big tall things. So that I think that it was a very domesticating experience for me. And what I ended up doing was teaching mostly. I had small galleries that sold big, you know, one piece of my big work, or but mostly I was teaching. And that's a difficult thing, to be an artist and a teacher, because you really become a teacher. Even you're not full-time artist exactly, you're teaching, but you learn a lot about what you think when you teach, because you have to say these things that are mostly intuitive. And I think that you become a better artist by at least teaching some, because you really do have to voice or understand with your left brain your right brain sort of abilities.
Yeah. I want to tell people who may just be tuning in right now, my guests are Mary Bate, curator at the Acadiana Center for the Arts, and artist and sculptor Lisa Osborne, who is talking about her progress as an artist. Several of her pieces are in the exhibit, the figurative art exhibit, that will be in the main gallery at the Acadiana Center for the Arts. So describe some of these big pieces that you were creating at that time when you got your new studio, and what were you creating? What did they look like?
They looked like giant pots.
Pots.
I'd learned how to throw really big, because I wasn't very good at making elegant little small things. So I made giant pots, and suddenly they became sort of giant pots with heads on them, and kind of worked from there. So they really didn't have any feet or base or anything, and that's, it's been a part of my work is learning how to make them more. They stand. Most of my work stands on a ball now, on half of a ball, and that's kind of indicating that they're not in this world. They're not you. They come from somewhere else. They're on. They're in their own world. And mostly, I think it indicates it to me as opposed to other people. But it makes me happy to start that way at this point right now. They're often standing on something else, or they're not, or they're on wheels, or they're in a cage, or a so they're on a pedestal.
Well, what you're describing right there is quite different than what is actually in the show or some photographs I've seen of some of your work. How did you go from the pots with heads to these much more elegant, elongated pieces that you do now?
Oh, how nice. Well, I think that it was interesting when the heads would come on the pieces, I would have a sort of this sounds awful, but there'd be a head near my head, and I'd think, well, when my head's near somebody's head, I kiss them. I mean, I would have these sort of odd experiences with
Pygmalion.
That sounds awful.
Huh? No, it wasn't the Pygmalion
anyway.
Who turned the statue into a real woman.
Right, okay. Mm-hmm. And then, I think that there's kind of a collaboration that goes on for me with the clay, is that there's I'm really interested in the figure. And one of the problems that happens with the figure is that there's a right and a wrong. You have anatomy, and you can learn how to do this perfect anatomy, and you make it right, and it's not lumpy, and you find all the points, and, you know, this is where the acromion process comes, and these muscles are for the neck. And I find that tends to be a point of boredom, or there's a figurative art that's incredibly well done that way is often really boring to me. I hate, maybe that's terrible to say. Let's see, the figurative art that's like that, it often just is a copy of a body as opposed to saying anything interesting. And I think that one of the things that's really interesting about this show is the abstraction of the body is much more interesting than having it be like pure anatomy. And so I think that the figures got more elegant, that's a nice word, thank you, because I was more interested in having more anatomy to abstract, that it wasn't just the pots, that they needed, some of the figures that are in there right now are like very young girls, but they have these very long, and not, they would never work if they were real legs, and that was important to these girls, or they're not even really girls, but they have tails too, so they're not actually girls.
These are pieces in the show that you're talking about.
But the abstraction is really important to me, because I want it it should show, they can't talk to you, and they can't move around, and they can't tell you anything, so they really have to show what their interior worlds are like by showing you in their bodies.
Mm-hmm. So it's very medieval in many ways, you know, that you could tell what was inside by warts and various things that were on the outside of the body, what the soul was like. So tell us about because the groupings that you're talking about, your artist statement is fascinating, talking about these various groupings that people can see in the show. So you're imbuing it with things that are important to you, things you've read, mythology. How did that start developing, and how did that end up in your statues, and in particular these groups that you'll see in the show?
Well, I think it's very important for me to have parameters in order to be creative. I think that's why I have clay, which has a lot of rules, and the figure, which sort of has tradition and history. And I think that in order to sort of corral my ideas a little bit, or understand them, or be able to have something to build on, they can't just be without history. And so I think I choose things that have been interesting to me. Herms are one thing, which are a little complicated, but there's so many places to go with it, and yet they're these columns that are sculptures. Anyway, they have a big history.
Tell us just a little bit about them. I mean, anyone who's ever studied Greek mythology or history would have a little understanding of.
They're a totem for Hermes, and they started off. Hermes bored Argus, I think. I think it's Argus, the man whoever had all the eyes. Mm-hmm. He was watching Io for the. Anyway, so he told him a story and bored him to death, and he fell asleep. And there was a trial, and they were going to put him to death because he was, I'm paraphrasing, I don't remember the story
They
were going to put Hermes to death because he'd killed a god. And he was, the gods chose to, whether they were going to kill him or not by throwing a rock in one pile or the other. And he won and didn't get killed. So his totem, or the symbol for him, is a pile of rocks, and you see that at crossroads or on trails, or I think in doorways, anything that's a crossing over point is often where Hermes was, and it sort of morphed into a pillar. Four is important to Hermes for reasons I don't remember.
It's messenger of the gods, maybe.
Yes,
you think the four corners of the world, or the four winds, or
exactly something like that.
Yeah.
So they morphed into pillars with a head and genitalia. And
back in the ancient world.
Yes, absolutely. And they were everywhere. And they were apotropaic, which means they were lucky and warding off evil. And so they'd be outside of houses. Romans took it over as a form. And they were taken on as a something that the Romans made as well.
And probably this went on for hundreds of years world.
Yeah.
Very important to them, just as some things are important to us here.
And it went from Hermes to other gods and portrait busts of important people. And
So what did you do with the Hermes? How did you transform that idea?
Well, I think when I was going through my pot people phase, that it was pretty obvious, because they all looked like Hermes. They were kind of columnar and had a head at the end, and I was pretty excited about that. And I think more now than the form of it, because they're very not terribly Herm-like in form, but I think I've taken on the ideas of it, and the symbols and the powers and the come from that more than anything.
Now, are these the 18-foot pieces,
no.
The Hermes? No,
no,
they're not. So we have another group, and they're women.
Yes,
and these are the 18-feet pieces.
Yes.
Yeah. What is this group of women about?
These particular women are just the bodies of the women. No, there's no legs on them, but they're in tall cage skirts that have wheels on them that work pretty well. One wheel doesn't work so hot. Anyway, and these were sort of going to be the three fates, kind of. They're not the three fates, but they're sort of three tied together women. And a lot of the cage has to do with things that are hidden. So you can see inside their skirt, but it's things that may or may not be for public sight. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also, they look a bit like dolphins or something when they're not in. They're just a part of the woman, and then the skirt becomes anatomy, which is kind of a curious abstraction of
I have to say that was one of the first things that caught my eye looking down from the balcony, was one of those pieces, and they are stunning pieces. And the movement, your sense of movement as you're looking at it, whether it's internal movement or just the body and the flow of the skirts, is pretty astonishing for something that's static.
Yes.
So how many of them? There are three of them.
There are three of those.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
There are three of those.
And how long does it take to make one of those women?
Well,
those are metal pieces, aren't they?
Yes. Well, they're metal and clay.
And clay.
Yeah, metal and clay. It takes as long as it takes. It takes, if I'm welding well and the gas is on, I learned a lot, and I'm feeling fairly humble about my ability to manipulate materials right now, learning that you need to have the gas flowing correctly when you're mm-hmm. welding mm-hmm. certain things.
I have to say, I think this is one thing that does fascinate people about women sculptors.
Yeah.
People especially who make very large pieces. Louise Bourgeois,
yes.
People who, like yourself, just make large pieces. And there's something that people think must take a lot of strength or something to make those. It often belies, you know, your actual size and delicacy, personally.
I think it just takes a lot of being able to hold things that aren't real in your mm-hmm. head, which I'm not sure mm-hmm. if that's a good thing or not. You can continue to see it until mm-hmm. it's finally there.
Mm-hmm. So how many pieces do you have? You have the four Herms and the three women.
There's six pieces. There's three sort of green women, and mm-hmm. everything's untitled, so it's difficult.
Yes.
And three male figures, mm-hmm. and these three tall women figures in the skirts.
Okay, and no fourth male figure for the four Herms, or that?
No, there wasn't. That's why I sort of abandoned parts of it.
I wonder what kind of luck that will be. If you have just tuned in and you're finding yourself fascinated by what Lisa is saying, I guess our artist, sculptor, Lisa Osborne, her pieces will be in the new exhibit at the Acadiana Center for the Arts. It is called Reconfigured Transformations of the Body. It is figurative artwork, two-dimensional, three-dimensional. Mary Bate, along with Brian Guidry, has curated this exhibit, which will open this Saturday for Second Saturday Art Walk. And I know that you're excited as well, in addition to the figurative exhibit, about the others that are at the ACA.
Yes, I'm very excited about mm-hmm. them. Well, in the side gallery, we have Ernie Fournette, and Ernie Fournette's show is titled Ernie Fournette, It's Not Easy Being a Cop. And he was a police officer in New Iberia for all of his adult life. He's now retired. But he had actually an art degree from UL and then LSU. He got a master's from LSU. And he does photorealism. And they're all police-related. And they'll blow you away because you think that they're photographs. And they're just this beautifully manipulated. Most of them are pencil drawings, but there is some airbrush, but most of them. So if anyone is at all fascinated by that, he's a real master at it. Mm-hmm. And then in the vault, we have Gary Rock, and he's a wood sculptor. It's pretty amazing stuff. It's really very, very beautiful stuff. He's through August 25th. But the show that I'm most excited about, besides our Reconfigured Transformations of the Body, is a show in the Coca-Cola studio. It's a fundraiser for the ACA's exhibition department, because we always need money. We need to buy a projector. It's called Doodle Virus, and it's a show where we invited artists to donate 4x6 postcards that they worked on. Some people have taken their actual work and just reduced it down to a 4x6. Other people have given us kind of doodles, and then other people have taken existing postcards and manipulated them. And all of these pieces that have been donated, we have over 50 artists so far that have donated, and over 200 works of art will be for sale for $25. The work will be mounted anonymously, which means you won't know who you're buying unless you are very aware of that person's work, so that everyone has like a free chance to get a big name artist, because we do have a lot of pretty impressive people that you'll be able to buy their work for $25. And this goes on for another month afterwards. So if anyone feels they've ever wanted to have some art displayed at the ACA, this is your chance.
Now, are these mostly Louisiana artists?
Mostly, yes. Mm-hmm. I would say that mostly
are from Louisiana.
Mostly are from Louisiana, Lafayette, but all over. Mm-hmm. You know, what we did is we emailed every artist who'd ever shown at the ACA and said, hey, you know, help us out. And we had a very good response. We still have a few people who said that they were going to give us something, who have
trickle in this week.
Yes. Well, the show is a viral show, so if you have something and it's finished next week, even after the show opens, we're still going to put it up, because there's another art walk afterwards.
All right.
And all of this is for sale at a rock bottom price. Making great Christmas presents.
Absolutely. And if we just cast our minds over all of the many artists that have displayed at the ACA that you and Brian have talked about, have been there over the years, that's really a wonderful cornucopia of artists.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So an excellent opportunity, as you said, to own a little piece of art and just to see these jewels.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm sure that's what many of them seem like, just small little slices or reductions of larger pieces.
There's some pretty impressive pieces.
Mm-hmm.
So And it's certainly, I think, within everyone's budget. We wanted to make sure that even someone who was on a student's budget could actually, you know, start a collection of mm-hmm. art.
And is there a limit of how many of these postcards you can buy?
We haven't gone that far, you know, but I don't know. You know, we'll see how it goes. Yeah,
someone
you know.
Brings a basket and just starts scooping them all up.
Well, we'll take that money.
And then maybe it'll go viral again, and these artists will replenish it as well.
Right. And then, you know, we'll hopefully do this every year so that it can become a tradition that we support
ourselves. We can start our own postcard galleries at our homes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Even if you have a tiny house or apartment, you could have a little gallery as well.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Exactly. Right. So the Doodle Viral Art,
yes.
$25 for a postcard,
yes.
And it helps to support the exhibit fund
at the
SCA.
Yes, the exhibitions department. Yes,
okay.
Exactly.
So you can put on more fabulous exhibits
yes.
you all do. I mean, it takes a lot of effort, and you need things like projectors and
light
just materials.
Bulbs, and name it.
Absolutely.
Spackle.
Yes, spackle. Lots of spackle.
Paint, you know, all that kind of stuff to cover up
Safe
all those
ladders.
Holes.
Yeah.
Exactly. We have tape, packing tape, boy.
So help support the ACA, go see the Doodle Art at Viral Show, and perhaps purchase something. Again, in the main gallery, it is the Figurative Art Show. My guest, Lisa Osborne, has pieces in there, Reconfigured Transformations of the Body. How long will that be out?
That's up through October 13th.
So we have a couple months
yes.
to see that.
Yes.
And then several new exhibits as well.
Yes, Ernie Fournette in the side gallery and Gary Rock in the vault.
All right. And Lisa, I know some people may want to know if you have a website or someplace people could go just to get a sense of a taste of your work.
I have a Tumblr page, which mm-hmm. is lbosborne.tumblr.com.
Okay.
And you can go to a website from there. I have one in construction and one very old one.
Okay. So they can find some images yes. as well. Well, thank you both for taking the time. I know you're
thank
really
you.
Busy setting that exhibit up, and we thank you for coming as well
thank
to talk
you
to us
very
about
much.
Your work.